Welcome. It's This Is Going Well. I think it's late, but I think we almost made it up to the wire. I am David Cooper. This is the show where no one's listening. No one cares. The show where every episode's the last episode. And today, it's science, biology, technology, nerd stuff. Get used to it. Coming up in about 10 minutes, it's science expert Dan Riskin to do a post-eclipse follow-up. And I promise I tape this follow-up after the eclipse. I promise. That'll make more sense when you listen to it. And then Dan will tell us why one man in Florida was sitting around minding his own business, only to have an asteroid crash through his house. Except maybe it wasn't an asteroid. We'll find out from Dan. Then it's where we came from. Abiogenesis. That's the origin of life from a scientific perspective. Genesis, bullshit perspective. Abiogenesis, scientific perspective. There is some new research and findings in that field. We'll talk to a researcher who's been on the case. Abiogenesis, it rolls off the tongue. Say it with me. A-bio. Never mind, let's move on. Then finally, it's tech stories. Apple has finally made it into the 2024th century. If that's even a century, it probably isn't. It's the 20th century still, but they've come into modern technology by endorsing rich text messages that'll work with other phones. No more blue bubbles, green bubbles, except maybe the bubbles will still be green bubbles. We'll find out all of that and more. I'm sure we'll talk AI with our tech expert, Carmi Levy. I got a fantastic nerdy show for you, but first, some stories. All right, folks, gather around. Our first story for the night that's out of this world, or out of somebody's pants. So there's this Mexican news channel, right? They're covering the solar eclipse on Monday, a celestial event that's about as rare as finding a taxi in New York. I gotta do better comedy writing. I mean, that is if you can call that comedy writing, but back to the story. Everyone's excited in Mexico. The moon is ready to play peekaboo with the sun. And well, TV viewers who are watching the news are sending in their clips. And here is where things get nuts, literally. We'll come back to that joke in a second, because that one wasn't terrible writing. Amid awe-inspiring audience images of the moon covering the sun, the hosts of this Mexican news show broadcast something a little bit extra. A viewer, someone who probably thinks mooning is a form of astronomy, sends in a video using his testicles to block the sun. This guy is a genius. You can't make this stuff up. And it's like they say, one man's solar eclipse is another man's testicular showcase. See what I did with the story getting nuts thing earlier? I knew you'd thank me. Now, when the moment the host realize what's on the screen, you can almost hear this gasp. Louder than the gasp my parents let out when I told them I wanted to be on the radio. Anyway, the program quickly cuts back to the studio where one of the hosts, probably sweating more than a gefilte fish on Passover, goes on to explain how the anomaly made its way onto the broadcast, which I would not have done. I would have just ignored it. They do their best to explain it. They assure viewers that they're dealing with live submissions, and sometimes you get more than you testicularly bargain for. And it turns out the video of the guy's balls blocking the sun, it's not even a new one. It's been circulating since 2017. Oh, it's the eclipse gift that keeps on giving. Don't you wish you were in Mexico watching TV instead of looking at the sun and burning your retinas? You want to get nuts? Let's get nuts. The moral here is never accept watcher, listener, viewer submissions and go right to air or right to TV with them without vetting them first. Because the odds are good you'll get something from viewers, but the goods you'll get are very odd. All right, folks, I read something today that gave me a bit of a chuckle. Chechnya has decided that music should only be a certain speed. Not too fast, not too slow. Like Goldilocks with a metronome, right? They've settled with a pace between 80 and 116 beats per minute, to be exact. And I'm not sure they have a good sense of humor about it, because timing is everything, but apparently not in Chechnya. They say that this new tempo is in line with the Chechen mentality. Now, I've been trying to wrap my head around this. Does that mean if you play a song too fast, you might accidentally start enjoying yourself? And if it's too slow, you might fall into a deep existential crisis, pondering the meaning of life, or worse, start listening to the song's lyrics? The cultural minister of the country, a gentleman by the name of Musa Dadayev, says borrowing musical culture from other countries is off limits. And I'm just imagining him at a wedding, shaking his head at the DJ going, no, this beat is definitely borrowed from the West. Turn it off. It's like musical protectionism. But instead of taxes, they use the BPM. Now, kindly, the government of that country has given artists until June 1st to rewrite their music? Because, you know, MJ, Cher, Elton John, Tupac Shakur, they were always considering the Chechen mentality when composing. Ah, these beats I just laid down are great, but let's slow it down a little bit for Chechnya. Speaking of beats, under the new rule, all rave and techno are also banned. So much for my plans to open for Chechnya's first EDM festival, strictly moderate beats. In all seriousness, though, this is a bit disheartening, coming from a country that supported Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Music's the universal language that transcends boundaries, that opens small minds. And putting these kinds of limits on music feels like, well, clipping the wings of a bird. But hey, maybe there's a silver lining if Chechnya ever decides to lift the ban. I'm thinking the perfect song to celebrate is 117 beats per minute. Just one beat per minute over their ban. This story is so ridiculous. Anyway, that's the news, folks. Remember, in a world where you can be anything, be kind, and maybe, just maybe, keep your music at a reasonable BPM. That way, people in other countries could enjoy it. Actually, don't do that. Idiots, the lot of them. Nature's marvel, the cicadas. The insects that appear en masse every 13, 15, 17 years, some number like that. I'm not an insectologist. And this year, trillions of them are set to emerge from the ground across several U.S. states. And I gotta tell you, some of these cicadas have been hitting the nightclubs a little too hard, partying too hard, and not using protection. You see, alongside the usual suspects, the regular cicadas, we've got the zombie cicadas. That's a group that's infected by, and I'm saying this right, a sexually transmitted fungus. Sounds like a plot twist even Hollywood couldn't dream up. These guys are not coming out to party after 13 or 17 years underground. They're coming out and turning the whole event into a love parade. A fungus love parade. And the transformation that's going on with these cicadas because of this sexually transmitted fungus is kind of amazing. Imagine showing up to a party and your butt starts to erupt with a chalky white plug. And then your butt and private parts fall off. Totally normal. And yet, in the true spirit of the show must go on, you keep on fluttering about, trying to meet people, even going so far as to having sex and smushing that white stuff on your partners, which is the fungus. And what's the reason these cicadas won't stop moving when they've been infected? It turns out this fungus is lacing their system with a little natural amphetamine, giving them the stamina of a marathon runner at a rave. Males start flicking their wings like females to attract partners, which doubles their chances of spreading their newfound fungal love. It's like Tinder for cicadas, on bisexual mode where you get a really bad STD. Now, where this fungus comes from is actually kind of a mystery to scientists. It all happens below ground while the cicadas are hibernating, resting, and the spores crash the cicada emergence party. As they come out from the ground, they get infected. And as for all the wildlife that eats the carcasses of these bugs, the effect on them remains to be seen. But let's just say it's not recommended you eat animals that eat fungus-infected cicadas. Now, as these cicadas make their grand entrance, remember, they're not just here to sing the song of their people. They're here to remind us that sometimes nature throws parties that are weirder than anything we could imagine. And if you happen upon these little party animals, maybe just take a photo. Don't bite into the white pussy butt. Were you going to do that? I didn't think you were going to do that. Just grab some popcorn, watch the cicadas fly around en masse, and enjoy the ultimate show of love, lust, and fungus. Oh God, I love doing fungus content. Coming up momentarily, it's Dan Riskin, our science educator, our science communicator. He's a bat biologist and he's a man about town. And I'm looking forward to asking him about what happened during the eclipse with him. I think he studied animal behavior or something. We're going to find out that and more as we talk science with Dan Riskin. Stay with me, stay with us, stay. Well, you can go, but don't go too far. Dan Riskin, I am rattled to see you. It's a subtle pun. How are you?
You're rattled.
Yeah.
Tell me more about this
because
pun.
There was an earthquake in New York the other day. It rattled me, literally.
And you're still feeling rattled all these days later?
Look, I do the thing where I reverse the numbers. So it was a 4.8, but to me it was an 8.4 because I'm terrified of earthquakes and I overreact to them, which this analogy kind of fails if it was a 9.0. But you get the point. I get scared by little earthquakes. And I was living in San Francisco for 10 years. And that city loves to burn to the ground and shake into the ocean every, I don't know, 100 years. But I made it out alive. I made it out without the big one hitting. And I thought I put that fault line behind me. What is it? The San Antonio, San Andreas, Santa Monica, the Santa Claus, the San...
Yeah, all the Santas. I think it's actually just Santa Claus.
Santa Claus fault, yeah.
Santa Claus hates San Francisco. So tell me about your experience. What happened all those days ago when the earth... shook before your very eyes.
All those days ago, he said, as if we didn't tape this the day of the earthquake, but it's airing a few days later. The construction workers behind me are annoying, so I thought these guys are getting into you know what. I don't know what. Maybe you know. They're being too loud. And then it was a little bit too shaky, and then I go on... I'm like, oh my God, it's an earthquake. I stand under a door frame like a two-year-old because I'm terrified of these things.
A well-trained two-year-old who knows exactly what to do in an earthquake. I commend you for that action. That is exactly what you should do. I mean, you live in a big building.
Yeah, old building. The building is pre-war. And when I say that, I mean pre-American Civil War. It's like, I mean that. It's 180, maybe 190-year-old building.
How are you possibly angry at yourself for going into a doorway? That was just good thinking.
My girlfriend's from San Diego. She grew up on the San Andreas Claus fault or whatever.
Yeah. Santa's fault, I think it's called.
So when a thunderstorm here happens, she's like, oh my God. Because in San Diego, there's no weather ever. Right. I once went to her parents' house in San Diego and her mother was talking about going to Nashville in June. She's like, I went to Nashville in June and it rained. And I'm like, is that the whole story? Where's the rest of it? Anyway, long story short, the weather there's perfect, but there's earthquakes. So I text her and I said, there's an earthquake. And she's like, it's just the construction. So I go on Twitter. Obviously, people are tweeting like mad. I get a notification, a crazy one, worse than an Amber Alert. This is like terrorist attack level notification. Can't be overridden. My phone was on silent and it was beeping from the city of New York saying like 15 minutes late. They're like, there's an earthquake. There may be aftershocks. And then 3 minutes after that, they're like, it's safe to go outside now because it was nothing. It was 50 miles from an inn.
There's going to be an inquiry on that one. Yeah, but you're okay. And
yeah.
Did anything fall off a shelf in your house?
No. I like the meme on the internet, like breaking news from shocking earthquake in New York. And it's a picture of one of those white lawn chairs tipped over, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that seems appropriate. So my experience back several days ago when that earthquake happened, because we're not recording this the day that that happened.
Correct.
And this is not a pre-tape
nope.
for that will air later. This really was many days ago. I was at the zoo in Toronto, the Toronto Zoo, because there's a lot of inquiry into what animals will do during the eclipse. And so the zoo is putting on this like...
The eclipse that already happened.
The eclipse that happened, yes. And of course, everybody knows now what the animals will do. But at the time, no one knew what the animals would do during the eclipse because the eclipse had not yet happened, even though now the eclipse is in the past. But anyway, the zoo has put on this event where the kids and families can come to the zoo and everybody can watch the animals and see how they behave and then record it and then submit it to the zoo. And then the zoo can make a report about what the animals did. And, you know, like for a lot of animals, that's a big question mark, but you know, they've got wolves that howl at night. So, you know, it'd be interesting to know as we already do know, because it's in the past now, but I'm just imagining if it were a couple days ago, it would be very hard to know whether the wolves will howl, whether the giraffes will start running around, questions like that. So anyway, I'm at the zoo and I've got all these things lined up. And then I get a call like a few hours before from a US network asking me if I can appear on their network to talk about just randomly animals and the eclipse. And I said, yes, I can. In fact, I'll be standing in front of a giraffe at this particular time. And they're like, okay, great. So at 10:30, I am ready to go. I connect to them. I've got my phone on a tripod. I've got a light. I've got three giraffes behind me. They're ready to go. The giraffes are looking very cute. And then breaking news, stupid earthquake ruins Dan's appearance on American TV. Stupid, stupid, stupid. I hate that earthquake so much. So the drafts were like, what's going on, Dan? Why haven't you had the hit yet? And I'm like, drafts, I got some bad news for you. They've canceled us. So we put away the tripod and put away the phone. And
awful.
Yeah. Yeah.
So playing anyway, for an appearance on a media, like on TV or radio, is a hit.
Yes,
for
the hit. Yes, yes, the hit that I was referring. Well, I mean,
there's all this lingo that I didn't know.
But when giraffes know it.
They do. Yeah,
they do. So they said, "What's up with the hit?" And I said, "Well, yeah,
yeah." It's just when I started this, everyone starts using this lingo, like when I was in radio, and it's just I didn't understand any of it at first.
Right. People talk about, oh, yeah, no, I got there and my shooter was there. And it's like, what? You're what?
It's like,
no, the camera person.
Yeah. On my first night, the technical producer on the show was like, there's a hard out on the 59s. I'm like, what? I'm like, are you trying to have sex with me?
Can we do that after the show? That sounds good.
A hard out is when you have no time to stretch when a commercial break's coming. Like you there is not a second of buffer. A soft out is, oh, if you talk for an extra few seconds, that's fine. And the 59 is it's at the just before the end of the hour, like you know, 3:59, 4:59. So a hard out in the 59s means there is no option of dragging it out. If you keep talking, you will be cut off and the commercial or the news or whatever will play.
Yeah, yeah. And so a hard out at 59 means they've got a minute of something that they are going to start playing at 59 that's going to go right to the top of the hour. And so you better not be talking in that minute.
Yeah. Anyway, so the earthquake happened. You didn't get to your hit. The eclipse, quote unquote, happened because, again, this is now the week of April the 9th or 8th.
Of course it is. Everyone listening knows that. They know what day it is, as we do,
too. How was the eclipse? But tell me from the perspective of someone in the past who hasn't seen it yet.
Sure.
Some exciting stuff going on with. I didn't actually want to talk about the eclipse because I didn't want to reveal that we pre-taped pretty early. But now that we have, are you going to be? Are you going to be seeing it? Or I mean, I'm asking you from pretending we're in the.
Yeah. Okay. So pretending that it's the past. I remember what it was like before the eclipse happened because I remember that we were planning to go to the eclipse. We had plans to go to Niagara Falls. My kids were going to come with me. I was going to be working in TV all day. And I was really excited. I thought it was going to be fun. I'm excited for the path of totality. I'm like, okay, kids, it's going to be really exciting. My 12-year-old is a little bit like, this is a 3-minute event and you're telling us we have to be there all day. Like, what's up with that? And so I'm like, oh, no, it'll be really fun. So I'm, you know what? I just remember that emotion so much. It's hard to remember exactly what happened during the eclipse at this point, but that's where I'm at in my mind. What about you in the past?
I'm just going to hang out in New York. I just hung out in New York, not quite in the path of totality, but able to enjoy the eclipse. I'm not going to look at it. I don't have glasses.
Glasses. I wish I could give you some. I got so many right here.
I'm worried about the zoo counterfeits. Gave me tons.
Don't worry about the counterfeits. I mean, somebody's going to hear me say that and then they're going to sue us. So sorry. If you're listening, please worry about
the
counterfeits.
But if they're listening, they already looked at it with the counterfeits.
Oh, yeah. Then we're fine. Okay. I can say what I want. Okay. So here's what I have to say. And we'll find out I'm wrong because a whole bunch of people will be blind and they'll be listening to this going, it's not true, Dan. I just don't think there's going to be that many counterfeits. I just don't think that's going to be a big problem.
Cool. Well, I'm excited for you to have already looked at it.
Yeah, I'm excited for the past too. It's neat. It's a neat way to be. It's a neat way to be.
It's fun. So the moon and the sun and then Aquarius and the dawning of the age and the total eclipse of the heart. Yep. And cool. That's very exciting. Yep. We talked about it last time. There are some things I do want to go over with you, but we've just completely blabbed on about earthquakes and whatever. Giraffes, who knows?
Time travel.
Yeah, that's my favorite branch of sci-fi.
You know, I just watched Jurassic Park for the first time in a long time with my 12-year-old. It holds up. It's pretty good.
Yeah. My friend, she's really funny. She has a shirt that's the Jurassic Park logo, but it just says Jurassic Fart, and she wears it all the time.
Does anybody notice?
Yeah, they notice. I don't know why it's funny. It's not like an on point pun. It's just.
I mean, Jurassic sounds like it means big, but it doesn't. It's a period of time. But it's when you say, oh, that's like that was a Jurassic fart. You assume that it was a very big fart.
The animals that were roaming the earth in that time were huge.
Yeah, their farts would have been glorious.
T-Rex farts. It's a great name T-Rex for a farts, punk band.
Brontosaurus farts.
T-Rex farts.
T-Rex.
Dung, digga, dung, digga, jow. We are T-Rex farts. You know?
That is actually a great name for a band. That is a great name for a band. T-Rex farts.
All right. We wasted all our time, but we're going to come back and talk about a mystery object that landed in the backyard. No, that crashed into a Florida man's house. I definitely read the article you gave me before we started.
Of course you did.
Dan, we'll be back with you. And we're here with Dan Riskin.
What voice is that? I like it. I like it.
I don't know. Shouting annoyingly voice.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. But I like it. Like I keep saying.
So
like
this guy in Florida is hanging around, Alejandro Otero.
Yeah, he wasn't home. His son was home. And Alejandro Otero was alarmed to learn that there was a hole in his roof. So there was a loud noise at about 2 in the morning, and something went through his roof and then went through 2 floors of his house and came to rest in his home.
Wow.
And it looks like, as far as anybody can tell, it is something that was ejected from the International Space Station.
So but what?
Well, they've got these battery packs, and normally they go back down on a rocket, but every once in a while, like, there are delays, and not all the trips happen when they expect. And so this was like in 2021, actually, is when they jettisoned.
So they just jettison the stuff? Like, if the Russians or the Americans or whoever's coming up there, like, ah, sorry, we couldn't take your garbage, and they got to get rid of it, they'll just, whoop, eject it?
Yeah, they put it in a Japanese pallet. Like some kind of pallet structure.
Another great name for a band. The Japanese we are the Japanese Pallet. That's like an art house band. That's like an alternate name for the Talking Heads, the Japanese Pallet.
Yes. Yes. I find that Jurassic Farts, or no, T-Rex Farts doesn't quite work for my Japanese Pallet. Like
no.
Something like that, maybe? No?
Yeah, doesn't it's work. Just a different audience.
Just another band.
Yeah.
Okay. I apologize for trying to use it in a sentence. So anyway, this Japanese pallet in space, had this battery in it. And anyway, 2021, it gets launched. And basically the idea is we jettison this thing and it'll over time feel a tiny bit of drag because, you know, like it's not like zero drag up there. There's just very little drag. And so there's a little bit of drag and it slows it down slightly and then it falls a little bit and it gets dragged more. And eventually it's going to hit this sort of tipping point where it just burns up in the atmosphere.
Kind of like
and
exponential. So, like it goes a little bit more, and then it gets really fast and whoop, burns up.
And then it catches fire and it burns it like, and so this pallet was like the size of a refrigerator at the, like when it started and it's floating around and people were tracking this thing because it's space junk. And there's this great guy who's on Twitter and he tracks these things. And so he basically was, he had like an announcement of when it's going to come in. And basically it was supposed to burn up over Florida like years after it like 3 years after they jettisoned this thing. And I mean, they didn't know it was going to burn over Florida the 3 years before. They've just been watching it. And as it got lower, they were like, okay, it looks like it's going to go. And so then it goes over Florida. And that's exactly the time when this guy had this thing appear in his house and it came in through the roof. So everybody seems to think that it probably came from space and probably came from space junk and hit his house.
Cool. Why does stuff burn up in the atmosphere?
I believe it is just the pressure of pushing all that air out of the way as it comes in, and there's so much energy that it heats up, and there's just so much energy released that it catches fire and is really hot, and it makes things burn.
Okay, you got us mostly right. I looked it up; it was a trick question. It's because the air compresses.
It's not friction,
really.
Right? It's not friction.
It's not friction. Area. Yeah, it's like air compression, and then when air compresses, it heats up or something.
You gave me a trick question on something I wasn't prepared on. Good for you. That was a very Jurassic T-Rex move.
Yeah, T-Rex. Jurassic fart T-Rex, whatever.
T-Rex fart move. That's something T-Rex fart would do. Or Japanese palate.
Okay, boring story out of the way. I fear fungus at every turn, Dan. Fungus, and I have tinea a little bit on my chest. It never quite goes away. I treat it with the cream. And then
what's tinea?
It's like the little skin discoloration fungus. It's like a cousin of athlete's foot, but I don't get athlete's foot.
And, but you have this fungus among us.
Yeah.
And it lives in your chest.
I think I just have a crappy immune system because I don't give it to anyone I'm rubbing chests against with, which admittedly is not a lot of people, but my girlfriend's never gotten it.
Right.
And I just, athlete's foot, you know, I just, fungus and me have a temperamental relationship. And apparently frogs have a temperamental relationship with a fungus as well. It's called Batrus chococititium dendrobatid.
Just call it chytrid fungus. Okay. Chytrid fungus.
Okay, yeah.
It's Batrococcitium.
My Latin was no good there.
Yeah, it's BD is the abbreviation. It's a fungus that has been wiping out frogs. It showed up in the 90s, just all of a sudden appeared, and it's been spreading around the world, and it just wipes these frogs out. And a lot of ecosystems are worried about the frogs. Like 500 different species of frogs have been affected. Several species are thought to have gone extinct, including the Panamanian frog.
Just that, from this fungus that appeared in the 90s, like pogs?
Yeah. Like it's basically the worst. You thought pogs were bad. How about chytrid fungus? It's wiping out frogs. Pogs never wiped out any frogs. It's right in the name. It rhymes with frogs.
Those
frog
things
fans.
That you would slam against the pogs, you could throw at a frog. I mean, I think at least one frog died as in a pog-related, you know, injury. Maybe.
Maybe the fungus was meant to wipe out the pogs, and there was a typo, and they got the wrong.
Do you remember what pogs were? You're a little older than me.
Little discs of plastic, right?
No, little pieces of paper or plastic, and you'd hit them with this metal thing, and they'd flip over, and then you'd win them. I don't know, something like that.
I never played. I wasn't a big pogger. But I did play Frogger.
Mm. The 90s were a time. Okay, so this fungus appeared maybe out of nowhere. Maybe it affected some frog somewhere and just spread.
So here's the deal. This fungus has been around for a while, and there are different strains, and most of the strains don't really hurt frogs, but the strain that showed up in the 90s is really bad. And so researchers have been trying to figure out, what is it about this strain that makes it so bad? Could we do something to it to make it less bad? And so they were like, well, sometimes fungi get viruses. Maybe if it had got the right virus, it'd be good.
Funguses,
I know, it's crazy.
Can get viruses?
Yeah, viruses can attack fungus.
Whoa.
So there are special viruses that go for fungi. Like they're not like, it's not like they get your viruses, but there are viruses that are adapted to fungi that go after their DNA and manipulate it. And so they looked at the DNA of a whole bunch of different strains, and they found that a lot of them had the hallmarks of having been infected with a virus that inserts its DNA into the DNA of the fungus. And so they were like, oh boy, that's exciting. So it looks like the one that hurts the frogs never got that virus. What if it got the virus? So they went and they found the virus, and they were like, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to infect the deadly the fungus with a virus, and that should hurt the fungus so that it doesn't hurt frogs as much. So they infect it. And it shows that, and the fungus is hurt, and the fungus doesn't grow as well. And they're like, yes, we found its Achilles heel. We're going to take out the stupid fungus so that the frogs are going to be okay. We've solved the problem. And so then they take the fungus, they infect the fungus with the virus, and they give that to frogs to see if it maybe doesn't work on frogs anymore, and the frogs are fine. It kills all the frogs. Normally, this fungus kills half the frogs. This fungus killed all the frogs.
Maybe so woke up the fungus's immune system, so it became super. It seemed like it was killing it, but then the fungus that survived was the super fungus.
It got mad. Yeah, something like so. The
fungus got mad.
It made things way worse. So the researchers like, ooh, that's not what we meant to do. So fortunately, it's not like they've released this virus into the wild and like made things worse for the frogs, but their initial plan that they were just going to make these fungi sick with a virus, that's not a very good plan. So now what they're doing, and this is going to scare everybody, but now what they're doing is they're like, ooh, can we genetically modify the virus to make it hurt the fungus the right way so that it won't hurt the frogs? And so they're working on that now, trying to see if they can figure out how it affects the fungus so they could make a genetically modified virus to infect the fungus to try to save the frogs. And I'm sure lots of people would be mad about that, but that's what they're looking into to see if it's even feasible.
Wow. And we've learned that fungus can get mad.
Yeah.
That's scary, dude.
If they hear about this, they're going to be...
Fungus is the stuff that turns us from dead body into, like, you know, bones. Fungus is the stuff that eats... Fungus eats us when we die.
Yeah, Last of Us is all about
the fungus. And if fungus is decomposing organisms and we now have learned that we can make it mad, maybe they're just, you know, decomposing dead bodies while they're dead to be nice to us. They're like, we could do it while you were alive.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you guys piss us off, we'll come for you.
Yeah, quit saying mean things about athlete's foot. If I hear you say one more thing about athlete's foot, I'm going to come in there and mess you up. It's funny, but it's not funny. I mean, there's a fungus that people can get infected with that gets in your lungs. It's the disease is called histoplasmosis. And the reason I know about it is because you can often get it in bat caves. So if you go into a cave that has a lot of droppings, sometimes the spores of this thing are in the droppings and you kick up some spores, you inhale them, and then it germinates in your lungs. And people that get that, like, it's bad. And they go on severe antifungal medications for a long time. And then they have a cough for basically the rest of their lives because it's just scar tissue. So I respect fungi. I'm scared of fungi for sure. And I would like to see the frogs win this one. So we'll see what happens.
Here's a question that we can easily answer in the minute left that we have. What's the evolutionary history of viruses? Like, in terms of abiogenesis, do we think life and viruses came from the same place? Or are viruses a thing of their own? We got a couple of paramecium swimming around, and then all of a sudden we got viruses. What's going on?
I don't know the answer to that, but I know who I would ask. Carl Zimmer is a writer for this, for the New York Times, and he has written a whole book on viruses, which I have not yet read. But the big take home from that is that viruses are everywhere. And there's debate about whether you consider it a living form or not, because they don't have metabolism. They really can't do anything on their own. They can only sort of hijack the bodies of other things to get stuff done. But they are at the bottom of the ocean. They are in thermal pools. They are everywhere. They're in every organism. And so viruses kind of run the planet, and we're just along for the ride.
Viruses and funguses run the planet, dude.
Yeah, yeah, seriously. And they've got their thing going on, and we think it's about the frogs, but maybe the frogs, to them, are just not even part of the story.
If there were like Star Trek-level aliens, you know, in the up in space right now, and their flying saucer came near Earth, and they scanned our planet, what would they say is the predominant life form? That's maybe not us, maybe the viruses, maybe the fungus.
I guess it depends how big they are, right? Because if you came down here and you were the size of a virus, you wouldn't notice the people. It's kind of neat to think about.
Wow. Wow. Don't make viruses mad. Sorry, don't make funguses mad.
Yeah, no. I'm not. Yeah, there's an Arnold Schwarzenegger line. I'm not a fun guy. I'm a fungus. Don't make me mad.
Well done. Well done. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Coming up next, a researcher who's found a breakthrough in abiogenesis, that is the origin of life. I find this stuff interesting. I hope you do too. We're here to talk abiogenesis, specifically research on how the first cells could have formed on Earth. I'm here with a professor at the Department of Chemistry with Scripps Research Institute, who recently has published on the matter, Ram Krishnamurthy. Ram, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So let's take a step back. For people who don't know, it's a fancy word. I get to sound smart when I say it. Abiogenesis. What is this, and what does research around this topic usually entail?
Yeah, abiogenesis refers to the origins of life as we know it on Earth. That's the only data point that we have. And the question is, how can a mixture of chemicals come together on their own and give rise to what we think or what we understand to be life? Life is a process, not a property by itself. So the question is, how did biology come from a non-biological, you know, collection of chemicals? And that is, for me, abiogenesis.
Okay, so we take a bunch of inert chemicals, carbon, nitrogen, hydrogen, helium, and somehow you mix them together under the right conditions, and an emergent property is the first cells of life.
You can call that first cells of life. People would say, you know, there are competing theories. There is an RNA world which postulates RNA came first, and the rest came later. There is the lipid world, which postulates that cells came first and the rest came later. There is also the metabolism world, which says the collection of small chemicals started in a network of reactions, and then things started. And then there is, there are a lot of competing, you know, worlds. There was even a peptide world for a while, which talked about peptides appearing first, starting things along. So there are people who fall into these kind of categories. I try not to fall in any of them, and we try to take a holistic approach. But because we are scientists, we need to parse one thing at a time. So we go from one system to another, because mixing all of them together creates a kind of a problem for not only understanding the system from an analysis viewpoint, but also from the results viewpoint as to what led to these kind of mixtures in the first place. That gives rise to some sort of a property that you observe by, you know, any techniques that you use in the lab.
So what are protocells? Can you walk me through it in kind of simple terms?
So you understand what cells are in biology. So protocells are simplified versions of this that could have formed on early Earth with the type of chemicals that would have been available on early Earth, which were not as I would say sophisticated or as evolved as the ones that you see in biology. Just an example, for example, you get fatty acids. So you understand the term fatty acids, and these fatty acids are part of that phospholipids that make up the cells today. But the fatty acids by themselves can form protocells, which assemble in water and give a spherical shape, which gives an inside and outside difference so that you can put things inside and keep them inside. And so these are the kind of protocells that people think that might have come early before they evolved into the complex phospholipid-based protocells that are cells that we see today.
Can we create any sort of protocells or protocell-like things in a lab using chemicals that have nothing to do with life? Or a better way to say this is inert chemicals?
Yes, you can. And that's the idea. There are people who study synthetic biology of these cells. You know, so that means, can we create cells that are made out of completely different type of chemicals so that we can use them for some purposes, either in biology or for material chemistry or nanomaterials. So if you remember the COVID vaccine, you know, that was created by these lipid nanoparticles that were able to deliver the mRNA inside your. So the question is, what sort of, you know, synthetic components of this protocells or the cells that we can engineer that can become useful for medicinal purposes or for certain application purposes in material chemistry?
So getting back to the origins of life, are we close to being able to recreate the kinds of circumstances that may have existed on Earth that led to life, or close to understanding that?
So we are taking baby steps. So if you are thinking about, you know, you are asking about how we can, you know, run. But I would argue that, you know, the more we find in this field, the more we appreciate how difficult it is to recreate the exact type of historical conditions that would have led to, you know, the origins of life on Earth. We have very little chemical clues as to what the chemistry was exactly on early Earth at that time. We understand the atmosphere, we understand the nature of the ocean, we understand the nature of the land mass that might have been there, and the type of gases and small molecules that would have been there. But then going from that to the type of chemicals that we would need to get origins of life kickstarted, that is still a big window of, you know, a black box, if you will. It's not a black box that we can't demonstrate. We would be able to demonstrate something. But then your question would be, how do you know that this happened exactly the way of 4.5 billion or 4 billion years ago on early Earth? That, you know, that is still under highly debatable circumstances, in the sense that we do not know exactly. Probably, you know, it's a truism when we say we will not know exactly how this thing started, but that doesn't prevent us from kind of reinventing or inventing the type of chemistry that would give rise to a property that is lifelike, without making the claim that this is exactly how it happened on early Earth.
I imagine designing an experiment that takes 4.5 billion years to run would take some difficulty to monitor, wouldn't it?
Plus, you know, with the current funding climate and, you know, the lifespan of human beings being only 100, it would be very difficult.
I love how your mind goes to funding and not necessarily to the lifespan.
because, you know, the lifespan, you can always have, you know, one graduate student, another graduate student, another graduate student, but you're not assured of the funding.
Okay, so let's go back to where your research is and the paper that you that we saw. Where are we at? How would you explain to a layperson kind of what we understand to date? You say, I'm sort of asking about walking and you're talking more about crawling or baby steps. Where are we, and how would you best explain it to a layperson?
So that's an excellent question. So one of the things that we do is, you know, when we want to understand the origins of life, we naturally look to what life is today and then try to simplify that to more simpler systems. And, you know, ask the question whether that would work for us. And, you know, we see there is a complete breakdown or some sort of a breakdown when you try to simplify too much. And then there is not the property of, you know, life as we would see it in terms of, you know, replication or evolution or metabolism and things like that. So we take a different approach and we say, okay, let's not look at life as we know it today, but let's look at the mixture of chemicals that might have existed on Earth and start from there. And ask the question, when we put these chemicals in a defined condition under a defined mixture, what are the properties that would naturally emerge? Are there reactions that would take place? Are there structures that would be created that would begin to show certain properties that might not be in the beginning compounds because you made a new compound? And that is the approach that we are taking. And in this case of this research, what we found was that if we introduce a molecule called phosphate from the very beginning of putting these fatty acids and glycerols together, we begin to see a natural transition from the fatty acid-based, you know, simple vesicles or protocell-like structures to the ones that, you know, are phospholipids, which are reflective of the type of molecules that we see in biology today. So if the take-home message from this paper would be that what we see in biology today may not be exactly the same thing that we, you know, see 4 billion years ago with simple chemicals, but there are, you know, simpler versions of that that seem to naturally arise, which seems to explain why the type of structures that we see today in biology may have been chosen because of their superior function, because biology selects based on function. If a molecule does not do the function, biology discards it. So
that's really interesting. Does it change our understanding of how life began?
What it says is that it may not be that complicated to get the type of molecules that you see in biology today in terms of their simplified versions, but that does not mean that you are able to put these things together in a beaker and say that would lead to exactly a life-like, you know, structure that would begin to do the things that life does. That's a very big step. And, you know, we really are far away from that kind of a demonstration. But what it slowly does is it breaks down the barriers to saying, oh, this is an unsolvable problem. And, you know, I take refuge in one of my, you know, beautiful statements from my mentor, Professor Eschenmoser, who said, you may not be able to solve a problem, but you should not adhere to the principle that the problem is unsolvable.
Oh, I love that. I love that.
Yeah. And so that gives you hope. And he also said another thing. He said, origins of life cannot be discovered. It has to be reinvented. Reinvented because life is already invented once. So he says that reinvention gives us a way to think of different ways things could have happened and not reflect exactly what biology does today, but then it might have transformed to what biology does today.
Ram, thanks for sharing this research with me. It's really interesting.
Yeah, thank you so much for this opportunity. Really enjoyed this. Thank you.
Ram Krishnamurthy is a professor of chemistry at Scripps Research Institute. Now, coming up next, it's Carmi Levy to talk about a recent announcement, ironically not made by Apple, but it involves Apple. They're going to soon integrate their phones to have modern text messaging with non-Apple devices. This should be exciting for anyone who's a, quote, green bubble Android user. So stick around. Carmi, welcome back to whatever the hell this show is. I appreciate you showing up. You get an A for attendance.
Well, I appreciate you having me back. You know, I don't often get an invitation to return. Usually it's one and done for me. So thank you for, you know, boosting my ego and, you know, making me feel welcome. I do deeply appreciate that.
Carmi, is it short for Carmine, Carmichael, Carmister, Carmeasel, Carwash? What is Carmi short for?
Carmi is actually my full name. That's what appears on my birth certificate. Oh. My parents, I'm pretty sure, were drunk when they decided to name me. So they wanted me to have a unique name. All of my brother and sister also were both given very unique names. And my name is in Hebrew, it means my vineyard, which is ironic considering I don't really like alcohol. Mm. But I do have an alcoholic name that nobody understands and thinks it's a nickname, but it's not.
Here I was thinking something out of The Godfather. Oh, I want to make you a Carmine's coming with his, I don't know, pasta and spaghetti.
I don't know. Not so much for, you know, a Jewish boy from Montreal. I don't really play that Italian mobster very well. I've tried. I'm just, my impression is not that good. I will not subject our listeners to it this time.
I mean, there historically were Jewish gangbangers from Montreal in Canada, like documented.
A lot of them ended up in, I think, Las Vegas?
Well, you want to make it to the big time, you know? It's like making it in showbiz. You finally move to Los Angeles. Making it as a criminal means moving to Vegas. That's your end game.
Go where the party is. I get it.
Go where the casinos are. That's like institutionalized thievery rather than having to risk it every day on the streets.
That's what the government says. It's okay. So here I am.
Here I am on the streets slinging drugs and robbing people when I can just go to Vegas. Not, you know, the police will protect me and I'll make all this money.
And have them come to me and I can even sit by the pool and watch the money come in.
I hate Las Vegas. There's no worse place on the world, but also I love it. All right, let's talk tech stories. This is something that has been annoying me about Apple since forever. iMessage. Apple loves iMessage. It's not that great a product, but it's the ultimate vendor lock-in. That annoying green text that you're not sure sent, and when you send an image attached to it to your friends with a non-iPhone phone, you're not sure if that's in high resolution. It probably isn't. You know, it's just a bad experience texting normally without iMessage. However, every phone manufacturer has gotten together and they have a standard for actual good text messages. Apple has just to date refused to participate. Tell me about that standard before we go into this story.
So it's called RCS, and it stands for Rich Communication Services. And it's been around for a few years. And basically what it does is it layers on top of the short message service, or SMS, that we're all used to, the texting that we've had for decades. And it gives it more capabilities. It adds read receipts, so you can tell when something has been delivered and when a message has been read. You can see activity monitors. So, you know, when someone is responding to your message, you see those little dots bouncing up and down, so you know to wait, okay, the message is coming, they're typing, so you can see that happening.
The dots of doom, the anxiety those cause me, Carmi, is like no other.
Oh, and still cause me to this day, honestly. It's probably an explanation for why I'm borderline high blood pressure. So and it also allows higher resolution video and higher resolution imagery. Basically, it brings good old text messaging, which was only text for the longest time. It brings it into the modern age. And just about every other mobile phone maker, operating system, platform, vendor, everyone said, oh, this RCS is an amazing idea. Open standard. We all just sign up for it and we'll all have better messaging. Everyone except Apple. Apple, of course, built iMessage using its own technologies, proprietary technologies, creating its own little walled garden, which explains why iPhone users get the blue bubble and everyone else is stuck with the green bubble, why everyone else is stuck with that lousy experience when they're trying to message with their friends and family members who use an iPhone. So, of course, Apple has always said, well, it's how we maintain a secure environment. It's how we deliver a better end user experience.
It's BS.
The European Union. Yeah, but the European Union said, no, that's how you behave in a monopolistic fashion. That's called antitrust. The Department of Justice, of course, has sued the company over this. And a number of other things. And in Europe, they've introduced the Digital Markets Act that prevents companies from creating these walled gardens or punishes them for being punitive to their competitors. They want open standards. They don't want blue bubble, green bubble controversies anymore. They want everyone to have a similar experience, no matter what kind of device they have. Give them choice. And so, you know, Apple hasn't said anything, but Google has confirmed on its Android website that RCS is coming to iOS later this year, likely with the new version of iOS, version 18, which is expected around September. So according to them, it's not going to hit in September. In other words, 18.0 version of iOS, probably not going to have it, but 18.1 or 18.2, one of the major point updates, will have it later on in the autumn. And it may not make the green bubbles go away. So let's not get our hopes
up.
Well,
we should mix blue and green, and I believe if my color...
And come up with a lovely shade.
Well, I think it's teal, maybe, is the in-between color right there?
Teal is a lovely shade. Very 90s, but yeah. I'm a big fan of it. Used to drive a minivan in the color teal, which I remember. Yeah, oi, exactly. It. But my wife loved it. But yeah,
it surprising to you that Google is the one who announced this? Apple, I feel like, didn't want to do this. They're being forced to do it by lawsuits and EU regulators, so they're just going to quietly announce it. You know, just kind of like when they switched to USB-C rather than those proprietary connectors. You know, they just kind of quietly go on with standards, and then. But when other companies, it's a big deal for them to be able to play with Apple. It's important for Google to announce it. It's not so important for Apple to announce it.
It almost feels like Google is taunting Apple on the playground. And Apple, of course, is very quiet about things when it's ticked off. And it has been ticked off about being forced in this direction in the past. And I think Google is having a really good time needling their biggest competitor in the market by announcing it first and confirming that it's coming. I think it's hilarious. I think it's good for everyone else. I think it's good for the marketplace to have open standards like this. And it kind of depresses me to see that the debate over green bubbles and blue bubbles almost seems to intensify with time. So if this change, if Apple adopting RCS even partially helps level the playing field somewhat, and so that we can all talk about something else instead of the color of our bubbles, or make us feel bad because we dared not buy the right phone, then I think that we'll call that a win for humanity, even if Apple isn't very happy about it.
Can we just discuss how I have heard people, not just women, be like, I won't date someone if I meet them on an app, they give me their phone number, and then they're a green bubble. I'll only date someone who's a blue bubble. And I'm like, you know what? I'm not dating. But if I were dating and I had it, I almost want to get a green bubble just so I do have an iPhone, just so I could eliminate the dating pool, because I don't want to date you, you know?
It almost makes me want to dig into my drawer of discarded products and pull out an old BlackBerry, and maybe I'll use that to message. Not that I'm in the dating pool. I'm happily married, of course. But, you know, this notion that we judge people based on the devices that they use, and, you know, in a past generation, it would have been the clothes that they wear or the logos or the brands that they represent, the car that they drive. It's just a tech-infused extension of consumer culture, and frankly, it's the worst side of consumer culture. And I think that's, if you're in the dating pool and someone is judging you because you don't have
they're
the
right doing phone, you a favor.
Exactly. They're saving you the hassle of having to say, sorry, I'm just not that into you. If they're going to judge you based on the color of your bubble, then I think you can very quickly judge them into the round file.
I heard you mention your old device drawer filled with BlackBerries. Those listening may not know, before I was in podcasting and radio, I was a software engineer. I studied software engineering in Canada in the late 2000s.
Yeah, the I think they called those the aughts.
The aughts. Anyway, at the time, BlackBerry was the hottest thing. This is sort of pre-iPhone or iPhone 2G. And one of the joys of graduating from University of Toronto in engineering is that some of my friends went to the company that manufactured BlackBerry, RIM, and I could say, oh, did you get a RIM job, and not get in any trouble? You're welcome. Thank you. I just bowed for people who can't see it.
That's a Canadian joke if ever I saw one, and it never gets old. Even after the company rebranded itself to BlackBerry from the original RIM or Research in Motion.
Oh, yes, of course.
BlackBerry job just didn't sound as much fun, so we kept the old joke going.
You might have liked the joke, but I got to admit, it was a lot of setup for not that much punch, and I had to somehow humble brag that I'm an engineer in the setup. Not a good joke. Carmi, we're going to take a quick break and come back and discuss various AI stories, including New York, who may deploy gun detectors using AI on the subway. All right, we're back with Carmi Levy. Carmi, welcome here to the show.
I feel so welcome. All thanks to you. Thanks, man.
It's like almost like that Donna Summer song that I love, I Feel Love. You know that one?
Yeah, better you singing than me, because no one wants to hear me sing.
Oh, man.
Maybe the national anthem, or maybe I'll just mouth it next time.
I have been sober for almost 5 years, but I was at a dance party in the desert with a bunch of hippies, Burning Man, many years ago. I may or may not have been out of my mind at a party. Way too out of my mind, sitting on like a couch in the side of the party because I just was too out of my mind. And then that song started playing and it just changed my life. I mean, I know it was just the chemicals in my brain, you know, that made it feel that way, but the memory is real.
And you know, Donna Summer, she created some of the most anthemic, iconic music of her era. And it obviously persists to this day. So I can understand it. I've never been to Burning Man. I've seen the videos on YouTube, and I would love to go to Burning Man. Maybe we'll put that on the bucket list.
Well, if you go, make sure you don't get a sunburn on your tuchus when you're hanging out with all those nudists.
Nor will I, although I will ask for Donna Summer on the set list.
Okay, yeah. Well, all right. I've been talking way too much about AI on the show, but let's talk a little bit more about it, because New York, where I live, is going to test gun detectors. I imagine this will use cameras. That camera will be hooked to some magical computer. It'll look at your person, look at the shape of your body, look at the way your shirt is falling over your jeans to detect whether you may or may not have a gun. Will it use the fact that you're a minority to judge you and prejudice you? Maybe. That's what's so worrisome about these things.
Yeah, we don't know a lot about what is going on inside that black box. We know it comes from a company called Evolve. They're based in Massachusetts. Their specialty is weapons detection technology. And so it's a lot more sophisticated than, you know, passing through a metal detector. It actually uses cameras and other sensors along with the connected AI to scan an area on an ongoing basis. genesis and look for telltale signs that someone is carrying a gun, carrying a weapon, a tactical knife, a bomb even, and then flag it for, you know, further investigation. And so I don't think anyone doubts that this can't save lives. It's you know, anyone who's ever, for example, after every school shooting, we ask the same question, could this have been prevented? Is there a technology that could help level the playing field somewhat? And this is one of those technologies that could potentially do that if it's rolled out in just the right way. So New York, it's already being used at Citi Field. If you go see the Mets, it's already used at Lincoln Center, at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And now the city is saying we want to roll it out on the subways. And of course, because of the way the law is set up, they have to announce it 3 months before it goes live, so the public is kind of ready for it. So they're in that notice period now. And the interesting thing about the technology is that there's a lot of controversy about this company and about the fact that it isn't quite perfect. In many cases, it doesn't detect guns, or it'll look at an umbrella and call it a gun. Or, you know, if you have a tube, maybe it's like you've got, you know, like a large scale graphic that you've rolled up, a poster in a tube, it might think that that's a gun as well. So it isn't quite perfect. There have been some reports of false positives. And also the genealogy, the company itself, is under investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Federal Trade Commission, for a number of cases where they say they misrepresented the efficiency and the effectiveness of its technology, and they were deceiving customers, investors, and the general public. So there's a lot going on underneath the surface. It isn't as straightforward as a technology that might save lives. And then the additional layer is, apparently some of Mayor Adams in New York, some of his largest contributors are also connected to this company. So
great.
He's got some friends at the company. And of course, that's the company that wins the competition to supply this technology to the city. So
I feel like Giuliani has done any mayor of New York now a great favor. Because they look at Giuliani today and they say, at least he's not as bad as that.
Yeah. Talk about a fall from grace. But I mean, this is New York City being New York City. And projects like this always seem to be released under this kind of cloud. And this is no exception. But add AI into the mix and there's a lot more concern over it. And there should be.
So here's my worry. The AI is analyzing camera feeds and it sees some sweaty, panicked, worried, urgent feeling Unabomber type, you know, kind of holding his stomach. You know, the system's going to say that it's a bomb and it'd be good to do that. Maybe it is. But here's my worry. I have IBS. Let's be honest here. I get diarrhea all the time and I get that panicked, glazed over look on my face and I hold my stomach when I'm trapped on the train when I got to get home and poop. Are they going to say I'm a terrorist and tackle me? I'll poop my pants, Carmi. I'll poop my pants.
Well, a lot of it depends on how it was trained. What data did they use to train this artificial intelligence? And is it fully representative of the of people who have
medical
conditions? I love
how you're taking this question seriously. I mean, IBS and I do get diarrhea, but I meant it out as a joke.
I just want you to be healthy. That's all I care about. And I don't want you... The worst thing is you've got to poop and you're now being flagged by this AI and a cop is stopping you. Like, sorry, where's the nearest toilet? That would be a pretty major nightmare scenario.
And the subway has shut down all their toilets as of COVID and they're basically not opening any of them. Maybe like 10% of them they've reopened.
So you don't get shot, but you have a very embarrassing incident on the platform.
Who's going to take a poop in a New York subway? You got to be mental.
Well, that's never happened before. Not at all.
That's like extreme, you know, tourism. That's like going to the Congo and hanging out with rebels. That's like going to, you know, Colombia and hanging out with FARC. That's like going to hang out with the cartels. That is one of the most dangerous extreme forms of tourism, going to a toilet in a New York subway. You know, it's maybe good they're closed.
I think that's an Instagram reel waiting to happen, or maybe a viral TikTok.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more. I guess the U.S. government's taking AI kind of seriously. Biden has ordered every single U.S. agency to have a chief AI officer, a CAO, a cow.
Yeah, don't have a cow, or maybe I guess do have a cow because the government is telling you to.
Is the worry that these agencies need to release you know, products? I guess products isn't the right word. Government services using AI, or just
what? They want to have someone with it, and this their timeline is very aggressive. This has to happen within the next 2 months. And Biden is basically saying every federal agency needs to have a chief AI officer in place in order to figure out what this AI thing is, in order to help position the agency to answer every question that comes its way about AI, in order to ensure that the agency does not, or the organization does not, get caught on the wrong side of the AI curve. Because right now, AI is rushing ahead, development is happening, we're seeing controversy after controversy, and the government agencies that are responsible for its oversight simply don't have the resources in place. So start with the chief kahuna, and then have them figure out, well, what are we doing about AI? What resources do we have in place? Do we have specialists on staff? Do we need to get more staff? Start asking questions, start getting the answers, start putting a strategy together now. And it's going to start, it's instead of it being a bottom-up thing, it's going to be a top-down thing. Start with the chief, and then staff and resource from there.
It's funny to me, because U.S. government agencies, most of them at least, except for the military, are, you know, criminally underfunded. And so it's start with the chief. They're never going to give them funding. So it's going to be a department of one. Like the Department of Energy is going to have a chief AI engineer, a chief AI officer with no staff. You know,
That's what bothers me, right, is this is one of those, it makes for a really great press release or a really great announcement from the White House press room, but it isn't really followed with any fundamental change in policy or in funding. So if the dollars aren't there, well, all you've done is generate some headlines, but you really haven't helped the government at large be more prepared for the AI onslaught, for the AI wave that's washing over society. So, good on you, Biden, for getting the headline and getting people talking about it, but this has to be followed up with action. This has to be followed up with money so that governments are ready to handle AI in any way, shape, or form as we go forward. Because right now, just by virtue of some of the hearings that we've seen on Capitol Hill, it's pretty darn clear that the leaders that are in place today, the lawmakers who are in place today, the department heads who are in place today, have no clue, and they're absolutely not ready. So, change the title on the door and call this person the chief AI officer is a lovely place to start. But that's all we have now, a start. We don't have anything after that, and which means the government of tomorrow is going to be as ill-prepared for all of this as it is today.
I like that as a slogan, a campaign slogan. Your government of tomorrow as ill-prepared as we are today.
Yeah, and don't forget, play the jingle.
That could be a good slogan for the Liberals in Canada.
Oh, absolutely.
It's funny, I am a Liberal and I hate the Canadian Liberal Party. It's like, it's weird.
Yeah,
like, I would vote. I mean, I guess NDP is my choice, which I would make, but it's like, by all intents and purposes, all they would have to do is just not screw up and they'd have my complete support. Can't even do that. I guess that's like most parties though.
Yeah, exactly. Political parties, I think, are by definition, they're built from the ground up to be ineffective. That's what politics is. And that largely explains why I never went into politics, because I wouldn't be able to sleep with myself at night.
God bless America. Carmi, thank you for being here. Appreciate your time as always.
Wonderful being with you, David. Thank you.
All right, that's a wrap on the show. We'll see you Friday, April the 12th. Thank you for listening. I am David Cooper, but I'm sure you already knew that because I say it all the time. See you tomorrow.